Hello, and welcome to Hanks for the Memories. You've got a friend in us. This is episode 4, Rona Jaffe's Mazes and Monsters from 1982. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And before we introduce our guests, I think I knew that this was a TV movie because it's marked as such on IMDb. And so when I put everything into our, you know, little spreadsheet that we planned everything out, I knew that it said TV movie.
I forgot.
And yet, when it started, I could not help but be disappointed in the low production quality of just about everything in this movie. You know, that's not to say that the movie itself is not good, which, you know, maybe it's not good. But I was picturing, for some dumb reason, because I'm a dumb person, something on the order of, like, Tom Cruise's Legend, which we will get to soon for Cruise Club, where it's sort of, you know, elaborate and ornate and, you know, mythical and magical. And here we are, opening with, like, basically what feels like what was that Charlize thing, her TV show that was terrible that I've already blocked out?
Like Hollywood Reporters or something?
Hollywood Confidential.
Hollywood Confidential?
Yes. Where it feels like that production quality was like, why is this? I mean, I know it is a TV movie, but still, could not help but be disappointed from the very first frame of this TV movie. But with us today to join us on this quest of mazes and monsters of epic proportion, the maze controller himself, co-host of the Now and Again podcast, maze controller Chris Podcasts. Hello, Chris.
I know not of this Chris Podcast you speak of. I am Chris Podcastus of the Now and Again realm, a level 69 socialist sorcerer. I've traveled far and wide to be here.
Oh, God. Hold on. I'm trying to remember Chris's D&D name. It's Kylie Minogue and Liz Phair. What is it? I can't remember.
You're not getting it again. And that was Star Wars.
So close. I will remember it, though. Also with us today, we have our cleric. You may know him from the Cinema Story series on YouTube. You may know him from Letterboxd, where we found him and found his delightful opinions about movies. We have with us Austin the Gray, Wolf Southern. Hello, Austin.
Hi. How's it going? God, I'm trying to think of a cool Mazes and Monsters name for myself. Now, I didn't think ahead.
I mean, we are not all as, you know, talented as Pardew,
right?
The Tom Hanks character in this. Before we go any further into this movie, I need to just mention off the bat that this is based on a true story.
Sort of.
Yeah, I felt that during the movie,
which is bananas.
I mean, it's as based off of a true story as, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is about Ed Gein. Like, it is a very loose adaptation of something that really only peripherally dealt with Dungeons and Dragons.
So the Wikipedia about the story here is almost more interesting than the movie, because what really happened was this guy, his name is James Dallas Egbert III. He was a child prodigy.
And this is who Hanks played?
Yes. It's who Hanks' character was based upon. And so he's this child prodigy.
But it seems like there are qualities of Egbert that also made it to the Chris Makepeace character.
Yes. It seems like there's, like, little bits sprinkled throughout. And because I feel like this is sort of, like, the making of this movie and the telling of this story feels like a literal adaptation of a game of telephone. So James Dallas Egbert III was a child prodigy, 16 years old, goes to Michigan State, maybe is gay, if you ask the detective on the case, maybe not. Either way, was suicidal, depressed, lonely, had parental pressure, was addicted to drugs.
Oh, that's not in the movie at all, so.
In college, leaves a suicide note, leaves, goes away, hides at his friend's house, tries to kill himself, doesn't happen. His parents hire this detective to find their son. The detective is like, I know what this is. It's all about that Dungeons and Dragons the kids are playing. That's what they're doing.
Oh, what year is this?
1979. And so he's like, I figured it out. I cracked the case. It's gonna be Dungeons and Dragons. So they, like, spread this, like, propaganda throughout the news that, like, it's this devil-worshipping game that is infecting these kids' brains, and it's causing mayhem. And so they look for him for several weeks. They bounce around. He moves down to New Orleans to sort of get away, so shout out Nicolas Cage. He finally gets settled in New Orleans, gets a job, the kid, calls the detective, is like, hey, I'm down here. Detective goes down. I think he brings him back home, and then the kid kills himself, like, the next year. So then, the guy who is the detective on the case writes a novel about the case, because he's like, the media misconstrued all this. You know, this is what really happened.
Is this Rona Jaffe we're talking about now?
No, this is a guy, William Deere.
Not yet? Oh, so there's a book. Oh, so there's a first book. There's more than one book.
Yes. So he wrote that. And then Rona Jaffe was like, this is going to be a great novel, because she wrote like a novelization of this. And so she was so paranoid that someone else is going to like look at this story and be like, this is my story to tell, that she wrote this entire novel in like a couple days. Like, she just like banged this out. And so she wrote it in a matter of days. They adapted it into this movie. And so instead of, you know, this maybe gay kid coming to terms with himself and then, you know, killing himself, it's just Tom Hanks becoming disillusioned and disconnected from society. And it is bananas.
It is not what I expected from this movie.
Same.
Yeah, me neither. It definitely, at times, played like Reefer Madness for D&D. And that's kind of like what the media's angle seems to have been for the story as well, to blow it all out of proportion, but...
Yeah, I felt like the movie was a little more fair than that. But it seems like that's how the media was. And that detective, I want to talk about that detective a little more, because the detective in the movie is clearly based on the real guy.
Yeah.
Because he's also very, like, kind of high-strung, and he's just, like, you know, he calls Mazes and Monsters a psychodrama. He says that it's dangerous, and there's, like, killing involved, and they're like, it's all imagination. He's like, is it? So he's obviously based on this real guy, William Dear. He wrote that book about this story, but did you see...
Yeah.
Did you look at another book that he wrote in later years?
No.
He also wrote a book called... OJ is innocent, and I can prove it.
Oh my god. Oh, cool. Very cool. This guy is great.
So this guy's great. Yeah.
Yeah, extremely normal dude, that guy.
So now, Chris, had you heard of this movie? Had you seen this movie, or did you just sign up for it? Like, did you know that it was like the D&D movie? Or basically, why are you here today?
That is a great question, because I'm not sure of the answer myself, other than I thought this was two different movies. I knew that there were some movies about D&D, and I mean, I played this since I was like 12, so over half my life, 20 years at this point, I've played D&D. So I know about the whole like late 70s, early 80s satanic panic that kind of built up around this game. It's something that parents could blame for, you know, basically anything bad that happened to their kids before video games existed. It was a great scapegoat, and I thought this was either... So I know there's a movie about a nerdy loner kid who has a D&D character and, like, plays D&D or something, or whatever the equivalent is, and some, like, bullies, like, accidentally, like, they prank him and they kill him, like, kind of the setup for a ton of 80s slasher movies, and he comes back to life as his character and starts knocking them off one by one. So at first I thought it might be that, and then I thought maybe it's just, like, kind of a filmed version of the famous Jack Chick tract about D&D, but it is neither of those things. In fact, it is just really boring.
Yeah. That's mm-hmm. about right.
Yeah, it's very slow going. I will agree with that. I haven't played D&D for a while, but as a kid, like, it was really cool because, you know, it was the early days of video games, so we were still playing outside, and it was a great way to hang out with my neighbors, and it was a very social thing to do, you know? And so I was very caught off guard by, like, the negative sort of propaganda aspect of the D&D. Like, that had never occurred to me, you know? So, like, I kind of got into this movie about that. Like, I thought that was very weird. I thought all the suicide stuff played very strange, because not only is Robbie somewhat suicidal, but JJ at one point, maybe we can get to that.
He seems to be the one that's like based on the real guy, but then it kind of switches to Tom Hanks' character, because JJ was also 16 years old and like kind of a prodigy who was in college early.
It was very uneven like that, but the one aspect I actually thought was quite cool was this idea of bringing the game out into the real world. Like, that is something we never did as kids.
Well, like, it becomes LARPing. Like, it becomes a different thing.
Exactly.
Now, Austin, had you seen this movie before, or was this the first time that you'd seen Mazes and Monsters? Because this feels kind of like right in your wheelhouse, knowing the kind of movies that you like.
Yeah, I really liked this movie. I was very invested in it. And yeah, it was great.
Was this the first time you saw it, or had you seen it before?
It was the first time I saw it, yeah. So I was interested because I was born in 1982, and I'm obsessed with that year just in cinema, and I will watch any movie from 1982. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to see it, was just because it was from 1982. And I really like TV movies from this era, and I think that might be why I liked it more than you guys did. I mean, this like kind of delivered what I wanted from it, of being this very like sincere, you know, not, I wouldn't say realistic, but like a drama sort of, but just very sincere in how it tells its story and sort of about something. And then, you know, I thought this was just like kind of a weirdo Dungeons and Dragons movie, and then by the end, when it turns out it's about mental illness, I was caught by surprise by that, but it also like makes complete sense in the context of a TV movie from the early 80s.
It feels like they're like, we need a message. We need this to be about something more than just beautiful nerds playing a game. These are like the most beautiful people I think who have ever played Dungeons and Dragons. Like they are, or I'm sorry, Mazes and Monsters.
Well, I mean, Vin Diesel he's very well known to be Dungeons and Dragons. So, I mean, he's a beautiful person. Come on.
Yeah. They talk about it a little with the blonde guy. They say that he's the makeout champion.
So there's two quotes that I wrote down. There's one, there's the point where Tom Hanks has moved schools, right? His character has changed schools because he, like, can't get his act together. He keeps falling in, like, with the wrong crowd, and the wrong crowd is, like, people who play Mazes and Monsters, right? So he has to go from school to school because his parents are like, no, you need to get your act together. You need to actually study, go to class, stop playing this game. So he plays with this kid, Robbie, goes to this new school. There, he meets in the library JJ, who is basically watching the bulletin board where they put up a, like, basically a help wanted sign that's looking for a 9th level Mazes and Monsters player. And so Tom Hanks sort of kind of approaches it gently, and JJ like rushes up to him and is like, come play with us. He says no. He's like, okay, cool, come to this party. He's like, all right, I'll be there. We're throwing a party. It's a birthday party for who?
Brigitte Bardot.
And we have to just back up a sec and talk about JJ's defining trait, if we can just throw it out now. He owns every hat on the planet.
Oh god, this is the one part I didn't like about the movie, was his fucking hats.
So the whole first like 10 minutes of this movie, I feel like, sets this character up to be the one who is going to have the delusions, if you want to call it that, about fake Dungeons and Dragons.
JJ or Hanks?
JJ. Because he's, I think, the first character we see.
Yes.
He goes up to his room with this overbearing mother who has made his room look like essentially a hospital room. He even says that. So that's some foreshadowing there. He has all these wacky hats. He's overbearing and aggressive in getting people to play this game. And then he's actually not really even a character. When the perspective does shift, it's to girl and the guy who looks like Fred from Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, it almost felt like it was starting out to be that actor's movie, and then it was like, wait a minute, we like what Hanks might be doing more. Maybe he can carry the rest of this movie. Let's kind of give him the rest of the character stuff.
Maybe they just rewrote it once they like booked Hanks because he was becoming a name.
So this movie came out in 1982, which is the same year that Bosom Buddies season 2 ended. And I don't know exactly where this falls, but I'm guessing either, you know, they might have shot it while filming Bosom Buddies or maybe immediately following, but like, he definitely has a little bit of buzz. I mean, this is still pre-Splash, so he's still not like Tom Hanks the name yet, but he's Tom Hanks the sitcom lead at least. But it is weird that Tom Hanks doesn't show up for like 20 or 30 minutes, and then there's another like kind of 15 or 20 minutes toward the end where he's just not, like, he just disappears. And for somebody who's top billed, even in the credits top billed, not just like retroactively like, hey, this is Tom Hanks' first leading role in a movie, like he's top billed here and he's kind of not in a lot of the movie. It feels like, in a way, Mike, just like our last episode for the other Tom, for Tom Cruise, kind of feels like Losing It, where it's like this ensemble piece sort of, but it's masquerading as this leading role for our main Tom.
Yeah, it's really tricky to do a movie that sort of switches protagonists in the first place, and like when, you know, these aren't necessarily strong enough to support that kind of writing, I guess. But I enjoy when a movie tries to do that, but it's just strange how similar the characters are. Like, usually when a movie does that, it, you know, it's a dramatic shift in type. Like, we start following one type of person and we follow a whole other type of person. I kind of think of Fast and Furious 3 a little bit when they introduce Han and it's like becomes his movie for an hour, you know, and it's like, okay, he's very different than Sean and everyone we've been following. But here it's like weird because there's almost two of the same type of character, two 9th level players here. It was a little confusing.
Yeah, it does seem like they did like a find and replace on the characters' names for the second half of the script.
Because there's also this like narrative in here where Tom Hanks is dating sort of out of nowhere Kate, like the main girl, and it doesn't seem like they are really together, and then Tom Hanks is like, well, why don't you move in with me? And it's like, wait, what? And he says, well, we spend all of our time together anyway, like this way we can, you know, we can spend all of our time together. And she's like, I don't know. And then things get serious, and then they break up when Tom Hanks kind of goes crazy, and then she just flips over to Daniel, who's a blonde guy, and she says this thing, they have this back and forth, like when they start falling in love. This is the first quote that I bolded. He says, I was always like Mr. Spock from Star Trek. I thought I had no feelings. like a Vulcan. I never thought I could fall in love. And she says, you're not like Mr. Spock at all. You're like the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz, who thought he had no heart, and all along, he had the biggest heart of all. I was always afraid to get involved with you because you're so attractive. What? I rewound this movie twice because I wanted to write down quotes. There's that, and then there's the quote at the very end, her closing voiceover, which I will read later.
That blew my mind how this movie closed out.
There's these things where it doesn't feel like there's character development at all. And then she has like a 100, 150 word sort of mini monologue. And it's like, what?
Yeah. Well, I feel like they developed the blonde guy, the handsome guy, a little bit. I mean, we find a little bit about each person of like why they're sort of broken or like what's wrong with their family life or like why they need to escape into this game. And his thing is that he's too damn hot and girls are throwing themselves at him, but none of them will like attach emotionally. So he's become the makeout champion, but he's just being used for his like makeout skills. But what he really wants is a girlfriend. And Kate is able to like see through his hot sluttiness and become someone who can actually get emotionally involved in. But she was also afraid to do that because she only knew his reputation.
And she plays Eminem with him too. So I mean, like, she's like the perfect woman.
That is actually a real issue with D&D players is just too much making out. People want to make out with us too hard.
Well, I mean, because also everybody looks as beautiful as these people, right, Chris? Like, they're all like stunning models who are like, you know, walked out of a Sears catalog in the 80s. They're not movie star hot, but they are definitely like print advertising hot.
Yeah, the one time that I did LARP, I didn't go back because everyone was just, you know, they were California 10s, just too beautiful. And I was too intimidated and erect the entire time. And I couldn't roll dice.
That's what blew my mind about the hot blonde guy is that, like, deep down, he wants to be a nerdy computer programmer that makes video games, and his parents just won't stand for it.
Yeah, I like that.
It was interesting, and, like, they try to give them more than one sort of problem to deal with, and, you know, right off the bat, we find out Hank's mom's an alcoholic, and his dad, like, they're really on the outs and stuff like that. Is a tense car ride to drop him off to school, and you're like, all right, I get some of this. But then later he has like his Oscar moment where he just launches into the monologue about his brother running away, and that becomes his core neurosis for those nightmares where reality and fantasy, you know, blend forever, and he wakes up as his character, and you know, everything starts going off the very deep
end. Know, it feels like they have different problems, but I think it all just comes back to like their parents have fucked all of them up.
Yeah,
like it seems like all of them have the same problem where, you know, Kate is talking about how she's like, I wanted to do this. And her dad was like, well, you could do that, but like twist it a little bit and make it practical. And it just feels like they're all being controlled. And whether or not they just want to make out with each other and play Mazes and Monsters or just not do what their parents want, it seems like their parents are holding them back. The movie doesn't do anything with that. Like, the movie doesn't have like a reason for that to happen or like really a moral there or anything. It's just these kids all are sort of rebellious youths.
I think it's something that kind of brings them together and something that bonds them a little bit and something that drew them to this game. And it's just there for that, just some basic setup.
I had a quick question because this was really bothering me all throughout the movie because some of the editing is downright Wazowian in this movie. How much time passes from the beginning of this movie till the end? Because I could not tell you if this takes place over 1 week or a year and a half.
It's 9 months. Because the movie starts with the ominous prologue that is 6 months earlier.
Right.
Yeah, Joey, the wraparound, I thought of you because you're sort of known to not like them so much.
No, and like, I didn't hate this one because...
You know why it was kind of good? It made you believe they were all dead or something, right? Like, that's what got...
Yeah.
Yeah, created some intrigue. Also, I like when the wraparound kind of, like, concludes in the middle of the movie. I hate wraparounds or any sort of setup.
Well, because we talked about, you know, what we did our Cinemakers episode, Austin, for Fede Alvarez. Like, the Don't Breathe starts with the girl running down the street, and that's, like, the final, like, 15 or 20 minutes of the movie. And it's like, well, why'd you spoil that? Here, I didn't mind it because it's so crazy that I was like, how are the cops involved?
Yeah.
In this cave and everything.
And also, like, you know at some point that when Hanks or someone has their break from reality, that they're going to stab or kill someone. And he stabs the guy, but the twist is that it's a guy who wants to mug him.
Well, no, the stuff at the cops is before he stabs him.
Yes, I know, but, like, I'm just saying, like, I knew that, like, there was gonna be that twist where, like, they thought it was reality or something, right? But the movie downplays all that because the guy he stabs is a bad guy. And then the guy also seems fine. Like, he quickly gets up and just, like, holding his stomach. He's not dead.
Oh, yeah, he definitely doesn't die. Tom Hanks thinks he killed him. But that guy is gonna be all right.
But, like, I figured when the opening gets where, like, sort of sets up where we're going to get to, we were gonna get that. But it's kind of, like you're saying, Austin, like, not a fake out, but it happens before, and then the bad stuff happens. That's when Tom Hanks is, like, loose in New York City, you know, trying to find the maze underground and the two towers and his, you know, brother who is maybe dead. Like, I don't know. It just is wild.
Yeah.
And not really in a good way. Like, just in a, this is what's happening. This is where we are following this movie now.
So it's like, it starts 6 months early, and then it builds to when he first disappears, and then he's probably drifting in New York for 2 weeks to a month.
You think?
I thought there was a line that implied that was a lot of time that he was missing.
Well, I think it takes some time to get there.
Okay, so maybe a little longer than that. I mean, did he walk? So where are they based? Where's the college?
So the real college is Michigan State, but that's clearly not.
Yeah, I think it's just like State University.
They say Grant University. Is that a real school?
I wasn't sure where that was.
Liberal arts school.
It felt sort of East Coast, Connecticut kind of area.
It felt maybe upstate New York-y.
Yeah. Because he presumably walks to New York. That has to be physically possible. So yeah, probably upstate.
The fictional Grant University.
Yeah, however long it takes him to walk to New York and then wander the subways for a while and do whatever he does. So, I mean, I don't know. I think maybe it was more than a month, but I think he was probably gone about a month. And then the final scene is set 3 months later.
We kind of get a gaming montage. We kind of get a bit of a dating montage. So I was like, okay, you know, time's passing. We're going through a semester or two. At least, like, things, a lot of things seem to be developing in a small amount of time on screen.
Yeah.
And really, it settles down once he starts having his nightmares. And then I feel like the back half of this movie becomes a whole other beast. Like, it really sets its mind on being this lost in New York kind of detective mystery thing. And, you know, I think it works. I think it's fine. But I also feel like I wanted more working through our neuroses in the cave kind of, like, I just like that metaphorically kind of stuff. Like, it really kind of came out of nowhere for me. I didn't think this movie could go kind of in that direction. Like, I was like, I thought that was kind of interesting, like, for a movie like this to be trying to tackle that.
That is true, that when they're playing the game, they never really draw any parallels in the game to their real life issues.
No, right.
Yeah, and I feel like we only see Hanks hallucinate in the cave, and that was sort of a wasted opportunity for everyone else to get, like, these fever dreams or something, and then maybe we find out, like, they were drugged, or I don't know, my mind started going in other directions.
Well, for a while, I wasn't sure if it was going to be an actual fantasy, and, like, those dreams from his brother were real, and he was actually going to, like, find his brother. Well, I didn't know if it was going to go that direction, but it doesn't. He's lost it.
So I have a question, and I think it makes sense if I'm right, but is the voice that he's hearing in his dreams, is Tom Hanks the voice of that voice?
No, it's Lloyd Bachner.
Because it sounds Tom Hanks-y.
Yeah.
And I could sort of see why, like, in, you know, he thinks it's somebody else, but it's actually, you know, just his own psychosis or whatever speaking to him.
That would make sense, but there was somebody credited with the voice.
And then just to clarify, he does say at one point to the voice that he's, like, falling in love with the voice, right? Did I hear that right?
I don't recall that.
I wrote down,
there was something, the voice tells him a lot of crazy shit. He's like, you have to be abstinent. Like, you can't have sex while you're questing. You can't even touch another person. Like, forget about it, opposite sex. Like, don't touch anybody. Like, the voice is his Tyler Durden, right? Like, he's, like, going Fight Club here.
Well, yeah, the voice is his brother. And his brother literally tells him in a dream, bros before hoes. And if you want to be with me, your brother, you got to dump your girlfriend and be celibate.
He says, I do love you. It's possible for me to love you without making love to you. And then she says, you can tell me, is it me?
Whoa.
Yeah, and he's just like, no, I need to be celibate because my dead or missing brother wants me to be more holy.
Pardew the holy man, yeah.
Is he in character then, do you think, from that point on, but he's like trying not to give it away too much?
I think so.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, he's snapped early.
I think from the time he has his first dream, like his first literal fever dream where he's like sweating it through his sheets and like hearing this voice, I think he is, for lack of a better word, touched. He no longer associates with reality.
It kind of reminded me of like, because I had just watched Captain America Civil War. It was a very sort of Bucky thing where, like, the game triggered him into, like, another state of consciousness and, like, he just can't shake through, like, break. And then there's a point in New York where he does have, like, a moment of clarity and he makes that phone call and then he just kind of sinks right back into it when he remembers about, like, the Twin Towers and stuff. I was like, oof.
Yeah. Well, I got the impression he had had a similar episode before and that's why his parents were like, you cannot play Mazes and Monsters, because I think last time he played it, he also got, like, you know, maybe didn't have a full breakdown, but maybe just got, like, too into it and, you know, started, like, having delusions. And that's why they were like, please stay away from that game, and why he was very serious about not playing the game at first. And he had to be, like, peer pressured into playing Dungeons and Dragons.
I think you're probably right. So he goes to New York, he climbs up the Twin Towers, he's about to jump off the observation deck.
Well, first he goes below the subway. We have to mention that real quick, because that was maybe my favorite part.
When it turns into mazes and mole people.
Oh man, he could have met a chud while he was down there.
Yeah, he says out loud, maze. The subway cars are a dragon. He climbs up the two towers. He's about to jump off. And he says, I have spells, I'm going to fly. And then JJ pretends he's the maze controller, calls it a game, and that sort of, I guess, not confuses Hanks enough, but, like, calms him down enough that he's like, JJ, what am I doing here?
He tells him he doesn't have enough points to fly.
Oh, okay.
That convinces him not to jump off, and then he kind of has a breakthrough. But this is also after, like, 30 minutes of the other characters being like, is there anything in New York that the two towers could symbolize?
Hey, they had not yet been told to never forget, okay?
It takes them forever.
And this was also before, you know, Notorious B.I.G. rapped about blow up, like, the World Trade. Like, this is before those, too, so.
No, this is after Philippe Petit walked across them, so, I mean, they were, never mind.
Oh, no, and also, like, they're very famous buildings, Mike. Like, there's no excuse for these dumb kids to not know about the Twin Towers.
Yeah, every picture of a landscape of New York has a picture of two towers in it.
Every movie, every establishing shot of New York is just the Twin Towers.
Exactly.
Well, what's even better is, like, they know that Hanks has had a psychotic breakdown and that he's having trouble separating reality from fantasy. And they're like, go to my apartment. It's like, and then gives like this really long address of like numbers and street names. And I'm like, he's never going to make it to that address ever.
They think it's Lord of the Rings. Is that what they think? Like, they think it's the book, The Two Towers?
Yeah, he says Tolkien.
Yeah, that's the only connection these nerds can make is to Tolkien.
Oh, boy. But eventually, and this sort of goes back to Austin point before, they eventually get Hanks back to like his mother's farm or whatever, and he's just there recuperating. We find out, I guess the twist is that he is permanently severed from reality, that he is stuck eternally as Pardew. But you know, the kids show up, and I think this is what sort of proves Austin's point that like this has happened before, because the mom says to them, just so you know, I don't blame you. And they're like, oh.
She also references other friends that he's had. So I think he had another group of friends who had, like, come to visit him and then stopped visiting him.
Because this feels like the kind of thing where, like, say the four of us were playing Mazes and Monsters, and then Chris is a psychotic break because that feels the most natural.
Obviously.
You know, he goes to his parents' house, and we go visit him, and we find him like this. Like, it's kind of a heavy thing to... I would want to go back, but it's kind of like, I don't know if I can. You know what I mean? Because this guy is, like... He's gone. He's not your friend anymore. He's Pardew.
Yeah, well, Kate certainly agrees with you.
I feel like it ends on a very even more disturbing note than that when they're all sort of gonna accept that he is Pardew and go on the quest into the woods and everything. I'm like, whoa, whoa, like, enabling and everything. Like, this is, I don't know, that just felt like an extra twist. I was like, this, I wasn't expecting that. I just thought it would sort of pan up and they'd all be standing by the lake, like, kind of like about to cry or something. But yeah, not the ending I was expecting.
So then we have here, so Kate in this scene says that she's writing a novel. And I was like, is she supposed to be like a Rona Jaffe stand-in?
That's what I thought watching it.
Oh,
but then,
right?
But reading later, Rona Jaffe didn't seem to have any connection to the world. But it seemed like that's what the movie was implying, that she wrote the book that it was based on.
Oh, I was thinking Henry from Bosom Buddies, who was always writing his great novel.
Oh, yeah. Peter Scolari, yeah. But then the way that this movie concludes is that Kate says in voiceover, and so we play the game again for one last time. It didn't matter that there were no maps or dice or no monsters. Pardew saw the monsters, we did not. We saw nothing but the death of hope and the loss of our friend. And so we played the game until the sun began to set and all the monsters were dead. in that moment, Mike, I was like, you know, speaking of Henry, this is like a very special episode of Bosom Buddies where like the movie for the most part is kind of like light and fun and then, you know, serious stuff happens. But then it's just like, oh, it's a bummer of an ending. And then it just, it's over. And then it literally says on screen, the end.
Yeah, it makes you really, you know, question your life choices, you know, forces you to confront yourself. Like the end of several season two Bosom Buddy episodes. Like, that was startling.
It is just mind boggling.
This was maybe the only part of the movie that I really got into. I like that it committed to its alarmist bullshit in the end and kind of ended on that somber note. That character did also have a great line when they came out of the cave initially. The camera like zooms in on her as she's saying this and she goes, "The most terrifying monsters are the ones that exist in our minds." And I got a genuine laugh out loud moment from that.
Oh, right. Yeah, they seem to put a lot of weight on that line, like it was this PSA in the middle of the movie. And it was, yeah, foreshadowing, I guess.
Is this a movie where there are two sets of caves?
Two sets of caves? Like the figurative and the literal one?
Nick Cave?
No, like I think there's two literal sets of caves or caverns. It might just be me either not paying enough attention, number one, or number two, just like sort of vague writing, but it feels like there's the ones and then there's like these other ones.
No, so there's the one set of, it's like, it's more like a mine than a cave, I had the feeling like, but you know, JJ goes down there because they're forbidden and he's like, I'm going to go down here, and like he's planning to kill himself.
Yeah, he goes down there to kill himself and then is like, oh, I could play a cool game here. Like, that's what changes his mind.
Right, like, that was, again, very abrupt. He's like, well, I don't want to die anymore. Like, this is the perfect place to sort of evolve Mazes and Monsters. Like, let's bring it into the real world. And then he brings everyone down there, and he's, like, charted the whole cave and everything, and you find out, like, it's a really deep system, and people have gotten lost in there before and died, and I don't think this is from the book. I think I don't think this is from the actual case. This feels like the most Rona Jaffe sort of like addition kind of stuff to me.
You know, what's really weird, and without getting spoilery about the show, because we're also in the middle of the season, but like the third season of True Detective is about kids who were like brought out to a field and like played games out in a field and then like, you know, went missing or got killed.
Oh yeah. They find D&D dice and stuff. Right.
Yeah. So it's weird that this is a story as old as time, a tale as old as time, and yet here we are. Maybe Nick Pizzolatto loves Mazes and Monsters, is like, let me, you know, weave this into my overly complicated narrative that spans time and space. You know, one thing we have not talked about yet is how very, very truly somber the theme song is.
Oh my god, I have that as one of my notes. I said, I'm looking forward to every time love theme from Mazes and Monsters comes up, because it's a bop.
Whatever may happen, where the road may bend, always remember we are our special friends.
But it only comes up twice, and then I don't know if they introduce it again after the two times in the first 10 minutes.
That's very TV movie too.
It definitely happens so quickly, like back to back basically, where I was like, oh, we're gonna hear this every like serious moment, or like every essentially cut to commercial break, or every time that Kate is on screen, and it just never comes back again.
But we've gotten pretty lucky so far in Tom Tom Club with
banging like, theme songs yeah,
and stuff, you know. For Cruise we had Sacred Love, we had Losing It, lots of great music in The Outsiders, and then obviously the Bosom Buddy themes and stuff. But then here, yeah, with this song, not that it's like the greatest song,
it's noteworthy, yes, that there's reason to talk about it.
Yeah. He Knows You're Alone ends with like a cheesy song too, right? I think it did.
I think so. The end of that, I don't remember the theme song as much as just like the cycle continues.
Well, yeah, that was the ending. But then it has, I know like during the end credits, there is kind of an unexpected jingle that plays.
Probably. I mean, that feels like the kind of movie that would have unexpected closing credits.
Yeah, like cheerful, but also somber.
And this is coming from someone who used to get high and watch the Lifetime Network, this was the most made-for-TV movie I have ever seen.
Yeah. Well, they're all like, I mean, have you seen like 70s TV movies? Because this is kind of the end of that era of the like really sincere, special works that were made for TV.
Like it feels, you know, early Keanu, and even, it's a different era. It's the mid-90s opposed to the early 80s, but it feels like even early Charlize, like it feels like this is a trap that we're kind of falling into, Mike, on like all of our, you know, actors that we're doing. I feel like Best of Times is a little bit different for Cage, but like, you know, Keanu was in those early weirdo TV things, and like Charlize, as we were talking about, had Hollywood Confidential. Like, it just feels like this is like a rite of passage. Because, like, I looked, and, like, most of these kids went on to do, like, nothing. Like, the older people were, like, in, you know, like, one was in, like, the guy was in The Godfather, and, like, the woman was in, like these, like, classic, like, Forbidden Planet and stuff. The kids all just did nothing except for Hanks, and obviously he became, you know, Tom Hanks, but...
Yeah.
Like, I feel like there's probably a ton of these movies that, you know, Austin has seen, or, you know, one of us has seen, that, like, it's just a bunch of no-names that just existed, and then that was their claim to fame.
Yeah. I mean, Chris Makepeace did a few things.
This has definitely got sort of, like, a Brotherhood of Justice kind of Keanu vibe to it, right? But like, I think, you know, 1982, like, made for TV movies were still legit. Like, made for TV movies came out to compete with actual theatrical releases in the 70s and stuff, and like, they came out strong too. Like, they were really drawing audiences, and so like, this may be sort of at the tail end of that kind of era where VHS, after 1982, VHS would become very affordable for everybody, and so you could just rent movies and things like that, and so you would watch a theatrical release at home instead of a made-for-TV movie, unfortunately, and then the quality and money would sort of drain from those productions, and they would get a little more, for lack of a better term, I guess, kind of cheesy or low budget and stuff. So like, this was still at a time where they were trying to compete with what you were going to in theaters on that level.
Yeah, and it was, I think, where a lot of actors got their start. I mean, there are the ABC after school specials that was on for years, and I mean, Helen Hunt did one, and
Affleck did a couple.
You can find a lot of big names that kind of came from that.
What was the name of that movie that we watched, Mike, before we canceled the Ben Affleck podcast? House at the End of the Street or something?
Oh, our April Fool's episode? I don't remember, but he was like
just laying in a bed
in that movie.
Okay. What year?
81-ish, I think.
Okay.
I wrote down, so we mentioned a scene, I think, earlier, but, you know, Tom Hanks is, when he's getting driven to school by his parents, it's like, feels like it's like 8 a.m., 9 a.m., and his dad is yelling at his mom about having too much to drink. He says, "I hate it when you drink," and the mom says, "I drink to get through the day. I was a talented, well-educated woman. I could have been someone. All my life has been what you wanted, not what I wanted." And then, Tom Hanks has a line that I feel works as a double entendre, like a double meaning, but I don't think the movie meant it this way, because this movie is not this well-written. But he says, "Dad, this is it. You better make this right." Like, he's giving directions where to turn, but he's also saying, "Dad, fix, like, this is it. Like, the, you know, this is the end of things. Make it right." And I was like, whoa, all right. And then I was like, no. Like, that's just a coincidence. Like, that's not the movie being, you know, intelligently, like, or well-written. It's just, they backed into that one, I think.
I love that. I think it was probably unintentional, but... That's great.
I think it might be worth mentioning that I'm of the opinion, and granted, it's early in his career, I think Tom Hanks is pretty bad in this movie. I think he's like among the weakest parts of this movie. I think part of it is the casting. Like I said, I think Hat Guy probably should have been this character. I mean, first off, he's set up to be. Secondly, he, I think, would play that much better. Hanks is such a kind of a straight man, especially now, early on in his career. He's never really done, like, Cuckoo Bananas very well, and I think it's really embarrassing every time he tries in this movie.
I don't disagree that he's not great here, but we just watched 37 episodes of Bosom Buddies, and, like, he is often the straight man, kind of, but he also plays crazy in that show a lot.
He gets mad in that show.
Over those 19 hours of TV that we watch, like, he shows a remarkable amount of range, and, like, I don't know I'm sure he could have done better here, but, like, even if he was at his Bosom Buddies best, it wouldn't have come across in a way that was, like, anything noteworthy, just because the material and what he's playing with and just the story itself is not, you know, great. Like, I feel like the deck is stacked against him here.
Oh yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just, it's the wrong character too.
And I agree that, like, he's not good here. I think that, like, if you had spent as ridiculous amount of time as Mike and I did watching, and Brian and Eisen a little bit, watching what we watched for Bosom Buddies for the last two episodes, like, he can be over the top and melodramatic and, you know, comedic and, you know, impactful and, you know, resonant and everything. And even at this point, it's just not here.
Yeah, yeah, he'll get there. And he got there to a degree. And like you said, in Bosom Buddies, he showed a lot of what he's got in his bag of tricks and stuff. It's just, I don't feel like this is necessarily one of his strengths. And we'll come to find out, like, he early on will work much better doing the comedic stuff or being in comedies and, you know, not necessarily being like the comedian per se or anything, but just in that tone, he's real natural there. I feel like he needs to stretch a little more to reach this level of complexity, maybe. I don't know what it is per se exactly, but yeah, I agree. You know, I think part of it is this whole, like, who's the movie following problem, like, what, who's playing who role. Like, I do think he might be miscast. He would have probably been better as the guy who doesn't lose his mind in the movie, but it's an early role, so it's still interesting to watch even when it doesn't work. I'm like, oh, it's because he works so well so often, it's kind of interesting to watch when he's bad.
Yeah, he maybe hasn't entirely developed his charisma to an extent where he can do comedy really well at this time, but as far as just like doing almost nothing but you just love him, which is kind of what he becomes known for and why his later works work so well, is that you just care about him as a person or an actor or whatever. We have this like attachment to him. And I didn't really care about his character. I liked him okay, but he wasn't developed enough that I like hurt by what he was going through or emotionally affected by it.
Because I mean, one thing that we read and we talked about during He Knows You're Alone is that like even in his first ever on-screen appearance, he was so well liked by like the director and by the crew that they didn't kill his character. Like, he was so Tom Hanks already that they're like, no, this guy's gonna live. Like, we don't want him to die. And yet here, I agree with you, Austin. Like, I don't feel that connection to him.
I mean, he must have had that, like, as a person, but even in He Knows You're Alone, which I just watched the other night, that doesn't really show on screen. I wasn't really connected to him as a character, you know, in that movie either.
He's kind of a douche in that movie. Like, it's kind of a weird kind of role.
Well, yeah, he's kind of a douche. And then I didn't watch Bosom Buddy, but I watched some of his other TV appearances like from the era, and like on The Love Boat he plays a real sleaze and just a total like piece of shit, and you know he doesn't like bring any charisma with it. But then I watched Taxi and Happy Days and he's more comedic and it's much more entertaining and much more enthralling.
The next episode that we're doing for this in 2 weeks is his three episodes of Family Ties, which I don't know anything about.
Okay.
I don't know anything about Family Ties as a TV show. He's in two episodes, I think, in season one and one in season two, so.
Well, that's, you know, Michael J. Fox is on that show, though.
Oh, okay. Alex P. Keaton, is that show?
Yeah.
Okay. I know that from Summer Girls by Len.
Ugh.
And star of Tremors, one through whatever, Michael Gross.
I think this is a good time in the podcast to do one of our games. So, Chris, you brought it up in a way so that Tom Hanks isn't very good here. We play a game here on our TomTom podcast. If Tom Cruise was cast in this role instead of Tom Hanks, Chris, what do you think? How would this movie have played out differently if Tom Cruise was in the Ronnie role instead of Tom Hanks?
Well, first off, you would have had some horrible idiot on the IMDb trivia section going, Vanilla Sky is the second movie where Tom Cruise jumped off a skyscraper in New York City. but also, yeah, it would have been better. I think he could have done the Paranoid better. I think he could have done the Freak Out better. Tom Cruise at this stage of 1982, I don't know well enough to say, but my overall idea of Tom Cruise that I'm inserting into this would have been a little more on edge, and I think that would have served the character much better.
Yeah, I think so. Austin, what about you? Before Mike and I go, what do you think that this movie would have looked like if Tom Cruise was in this role instead of Tom Hanks?
It's hard to picture Tom Cruise in this role, because it is kind of a, I guess, like square type of role. It's hard to imagine Tom Cruise playing Dungeons and Dragons, even in the 80s.
Well, so weirdly, in Taps, Mike, I forgot this until just now, the first line he says in the movie Taps, which does not have anything to do with his character.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
He's running up the stairs as other characters are coming down. He says, hey, you guys want to play D&D tonight? And I was like, what?
Oh, wow.
It's just, you know, a military boys academy or whatever, but that character at least was into it. And I feel like sort of kind of his losing it character would have also, he was sort of, it was in the 50s, but he sort of buttoned up enough that he would have been down to play an RPG, or you know what I mean? So.
Okay. So maybe I'm not familiar enough with early 80s Cruise.
Because right now, like, we've sort of seen to this point through the four Tom Cruise movies that we've watched, two very different Tom Cruises. We've seen very buttoned up and intense, or sort of like real kind of wild and intense sort of, right? Like Billy the Arsonist and The Outsiders, and then sort of Taps and losing it. So it feels like there's sort of two extremes. I do feel like he would have brought a little bit more energy to this, a little bit more mania. Like, you know, Tom Hanks was obviously crazy.
Well, yeah, thinking of how I know Tom Cruise, I feel like he would have kind of out-acted this movie. And maybe he would have made it better, more exciting, but I feel like he would bring so much mania and intensity that it would feel almost inappropriate to the tone of the film, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I would still like it, I'm sure.
Mike, what about you? How do you think, I mean, we're sort of workshopping it all together here, but how do you think Tom Cruise would have fared in Mazes and Monsters?
Yeah, you know, the one thing I think would have worked really well is, like, he would have been a good foil for Daniel, the hot blonde. Like, you would have had, like, a good-looking, you know what I mean? Like, it would have been a little balanced in that way. The sort of love triangle would have maybe been explored a little better, possibly. I don't know, just on a surface level kind of thing, you know, because I just figure, I think Tom Cruise is more attractive than Tom Hanks. So I just feel like on that level alone, it would have been different. And like you said, like, he can play sort of reserved really well, right? Like, he could do that. And then he also explodes. Like, I think Taps is a good, I think, like, he could almost be his Taps character in this movie, because that guy, like, is trying to keep it together the whole movie. And then at the end, he just loses his mind, right? And he just sort of takes on the entire military academy and everything. And he just tries to run everything. And I feel like there's kind of parallels there between these two characters somehow, about like these sort of late teens with all this pressure that are way too into one certain thing, and they take it way too seriously, and then it just kind of takes over their persona and everything. So I think it would work. I think he would be scarier when he makes the turn and all that kind of stuff. And one thing that would work really well is all that running in his nightmares, you know? So that would have fit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He would definitely run to New York instead of walking.
Yeah. Because I feel like when he snaps, when the character snaps in this movie, there's kind of two ways to play it. Like, you could play, like, scary and intense, or kind of like lost puppy dog. And I feel like Tom Hanks is kind of stuck in between, kind of. I think he wants to be more intimidating, and maybe either he doesn't have the chops yet, or the writing is just not there, or, like, the writing doesn't give him what he needs. But I feel like Tom Cruise would have committed fully to that, you know, scary, intense, where it feels like when he's approaching those muggers, I also feel like it's kind of goofy toward the end here. You know what I mean? Like, when, like, we see it, actually it's a person, but then we see, like, a goblin on screen.
Yeah, that suit isn't the best, right?
Yeah.
It's a Gorville.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Gorville Redenbacher was amazing.
I also just want to, point out, he's no Cheddar Goblin, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, and the person who plays the Gorville is someone we know.
What?
Is it really?
No way. Is it Van Damme?
Well, that's a weird guess. It's the Predator.
Oh.
Oh, it's the guy who actually played the Predator?
It's the guy who played the Predator, who took over the role from Van Damme.
Wow.
Whoa.
Huh. Kevin Peter Hall.
Oh, yeah. I think he's also the helicopter pilot in Predator. Yeah.
Yeah, Kevin Peter Hall. So he was in Predator, and then he was Harry in Harry and the Hendersons.
Wow.
Oh, no kidding. He played the Sasquatch. Wow.
Yeah, so he made a career of those types of roles.
He was like the first Doug Jones or Andy Serkis. This man should be known more.
He's Proto Serkis. I do want to point out that I just found in my messenger history with Chris, Fair Kaimin, and your defense of that was, hey man, George Lucas School of Naming was necessary when you played D&D, like, for 14-year-olds and had 40 characters instead of one, so Fair Kaimin, m'lady, to you.
If you put some apostrophes in that, it's a straight-up Star Wars name, so.
So now, Fair, what was your favorite moment in this movie? I know that you gave us half a star on Letterboxd. Not that any of us were particularly generous with our ratings. I'm sure that Austin's going to give it maybe more than the three of us combined, but...
Oh, this is a four-star movie.
Yeah, so more than the three of us combined, or at least, you know, combined our three scores. Did you have a favorite moment, Chris?
I had a couple of favorite moments. Like I said, the love theme. I really enjoyed that song. Send that over to Now and Again, please.
Together, whenever our lives may take us away, forever our memories will stay.
I enjoyed this is like such a cliche of gaming, like spooky gaming, like Satan's gaming. I enjoyed them playing in a giant room full of candles. That got a pretty good laugh out of me. Lots of books, lots of maps, nary a D20 to be found in Mazes and Monsters. They needed to get somebody on that.
It feels like the kind of thing where like nobody on set had ever played a game that even remotely resembled this. And so they were all just taking a stab in the dark at it.
Anyone who participated in the Satanic Panic stuff, like, never actually did or watched any of the things they were rebelling against or protesting.
Yeah.
And like I said, I actually really liked that if they're going to go kind of pearl clutchy on, you know, Reader's Digest, scare the moms with this movie, I like that they went all in and they didn't have a happy ending. They had a kind of somber ending, and I like that they stuck to their guns on that one.
On the other side of the coin, did you have a, aside from, I guess, just most of the movie, did you have a particular least favorite moment?
Yes, I did, actually. The quote-unquote chase scene through the World Trade Centers where, like, it's just these really static shots of them in an elevator, then on an escalator, and then they're moving down a hallway, and it's edited really quickly and choppily, and it's just, it's like 45 seconds of some really horrible made-for-TV filmmaking.
It's also, they're trying to find him somewhere within hundreds of floors in two buildings.
Yeah.
And they do.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was kind of impressed that they were actually shooting in the World Trade Center.
Same.
It's 1982 and everything like that, but I can't recall another movie I think I've seen with the lobby of the World Trade Center in it.
I think after they saw this movie, they're like, oh, let's not have any more movies shot here.
Yeah.
We'll be remembered for other things.
Well, so it's kind of funny that he's on the top of the World Trade Center, because doesn't he get to the top of the Empire State Building in Sleepless in Seattle or something? I haven't seen that.
Spoilers, I don't know yet.
I haven't seen it, but...
But aren't they in Seattle? Wouldn't it be the Space Needle, or no?
You would think so, but there is a massive plot point involving the Empire State Building. You're right.
Well, we'll have to watch it to find out what the hell happens.
We will find out in Nora Ephron month. Austin, what about you? What was your favorite moment in a movie full of moments that you enjoyed?
Yeah, it's hard. I liked a lot of it. I think just the closing moments really, like, hit me and took me by such surprise of just, like, they visit their friend and he's, you know, I guess a lost cause, and that the movie ends with her saying, we saw nothing but the death of hope and the loss of our friend.
And so we played the game again for one last time. It didn't matter that there were no maps or dice or no monsters. Pardieu saw the monsters. We did not. We saw nothing but the death of hope and the loss of our friend. And so we played the game until the sun began to set and all the monsters were dead.
And it's clear that they're never going to visit him again, and they consider him lost, like he's dead to them because he's...
gone forever.
Yeah, and it's so bleak. So that, I was so surprised by that, that was my favorite moment.
I wonder if his last set of friends showed up the previous time he had the incident and were like, we'll do one more round and then we're never coming back.
I think that's exactly what happened. The mom kind of implies that. She's like, his other friends have stopped coming around. And they're like, oh, we won't do that. But then we find out, like, they're going to do the exact same thing. And maybe in a year, he'll get better and go to a new college and make a new set of Mazes and Monsters friends. And this whole cycle will repeat.
And do you have a least favorite moment?
JJ's hats.
Good answer.
All right, pretty fair. Mike, what about you? What was your favorite moment in Mazes and Monsters?
So, like, I really, for some reason, I really like the back half of this movie, like, when it becomes, like, the search for Hanks. It's weird. Funny enough, it feels like the movie finally finds its focus. Like, it feels also like it's the most sort of straight adaption from the real-life story, for the most part. You know, once they get away from all the tomfoolery at the college, and it's, like, the missing persons sort of thing. But probably my favorite moment is when he goes into the lower depths underground beneath the subway into the forgotten tunnels of New York City and sort of wanders through. Like, I was getting a lot of sort of claustrophobic anxiety from watching it, going like, oh my gosh, like, you know, he's never going to find his way out of there. And then he runs into the magical bum, which was incredible, that moment, that whole thing, and talking about the dragon above and every and all that, and that's the guy who tells him where the two towers is. But I thought, like, oh, maybe Hanks should have gotten lost, like, at a half an hour, and the movie is them trying to find him for the rest of it, and we see all the crazy people he runs into on his way to New York City, and he thinks they're each sort of like these mythical benchmarks on his map or something. So I like that part of the movie.
And then they never find him, and he's just it ends with him as a transient in New York living under the subways.
That could actually add, like, some tension instead of them just being like, duh, what's the two towers? Like, they could be following, like, a quest that he wrote and so at some point be like, oh, this would be where he's in the woods. He must be in Central Park. Oh, we just missed him. Time to go into the caverns. And, like, following a whole quest line that this character had done before. Like, first off, that adds, like, a lot of money to the budget. But they didn't have to do it in New York City. But also, like, that, like I said, that adds some stakes. That adds a chase instead of just having a bunch of idiots going to New York City and the main action point of the movie being sitting around and then taking an escalator.
And, like, not to be morbid, but, like, the real kid that this is supposedly based on, like, left the suicide note. Like, why couldn't Tom Hanks have, like, left, like, this kind of, you know, manifesto or something that they have to use, like, Chris, like you're saying, like, you know, to sort of decipher where he went? You know what I mean? Like, it feels like if this is based on something, you could sort of take inspiration in a way from that. I don't know. Because, like, it all feels like basing a movie on this story feels morbid enough already. Like, why not go that extra little, you know, step or whatever?
That could have been more interesting if they could read his map, because they do continually refer to the map and look at it and are just like, well, I don't know. So, I mean, yeah, that would have been better if they could actually interpret something from it.
Because, like, the detective sees him, like, it's like this, like, you know, like, these are the ravings of a madman or whatever. Like, no, we actually know what this means. Like, this is this, and this is this, and, like...
It was frustrating that they could not figure out Two Towers. And the other part that frustrated me is when they find him in the Two Towers and they keep shouting his real name. They keep shouting Robbie. And it's like, you know he's in character. Just shout Patronus or whatever his name was. Like, just shout his game name and he'll respond. And they finally do it seconds before he jumps off the building.
Pardew,
yeah.
What was your least favorite moment, Mike?
Okay, I think I'm going to have to go with his nightmare visions. One was okay. Two, all right. But, like, weren't there, like, three or four? I don't know. I feel like they went a little overboard and they were quite long. And I felt like they could have been done a lot better. It reeked of, like, let's be cryptic, but, like, we don't know how, sort of. Let's just, okay, you know, the Fellini, they are not, right? I mean, he's just sort of running down a tunnel toward a light with a guy at the end of it shouting weird things. That kind of, like, took me out of it a lot. So I could have to say I wish they did a little better on those nightmare sequences.
You know, I think my favorite moment, aside from the quotes that I've already read, when the detective is trying to make sense of this world, and, you know, he's talking to that kid, and he's like, you play? And the kid's like, nah, it takes up a good deal of time. I'm a straight-A student. Like, I couldn't do this. And then he's just asking, I think it's the friends that we know, and he's just like, is Robbie a doper? Downers? Drink? And, like, he's just, like, it's like this hard-boiled detective in a world that does not fit him, and it feels wildly out of place, and it feels like the movie kind of grinds to a halt, and yet I love that character. Like, it doesn't make sense in this world to spend so much time with him, but I love that he's here.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's super hard-boiled. Like, he's out of a noir. I think that's why I like the second half so much.
My least favorite moment, only because we did not get to see it, is that when they find out that Tom Hanks is, like, basically not leaving character, and they say something along the lines of, like, he's going around blessing people and giving away his belongings. And I was like, why don't we see that? Why are we not seeing that? Like, that would be the greatest for him in, like, you know, in a cloak and scepter, just, like, walking around campus blessing people. Like, I would love that. And so to be teased with the promise of that but not to deliver is disappointing. Any other thoughts about Mazes and Monsters before we play one more game and then, you know, do the awards? Any other thoughts, Chris? Any other, you know, burning Mazes and Monsters thoughts to get off your chest before we do a couple other things?
Do we do, like, recommendations on this show? Do you ask, like, if you would have people watch it or not?
We could do a real good, sure. I mean, we could steal from another show on our network real bad. Like, you know, if you want to see a movie like this, essentially, but you don't want to watch Mazes and Monsters, which this is available for free on Amazon Prime. If you want to watch this, you can. Not that you should, but you can pretty easily.
If you think that this idea of someone getting lost in a fantasy realm, and especially if you want to pair it with, like, a coming-of-age story, and you still want a little bit of, like, feels going on, and you don't need all the alarmist kind of attitude, watch Bridge to Terabithia, or read the book. Really, really fucking good book, really fucking good movie. It's like a young adult thing about kids who use a fantasy world to get away from the real world, and it actually has things happen in it, so it's by default a better movie than this.
Well, that's not bad. You know, that reminds me, Mike, you know, last week on our Cruise Club episode, we both guessed what this movie would be about. I will guess later, you know, what Risky Business is about, but we were both kind of wrong. You were, I think, a little bit more correct. Like, I thought that this would be like a new Jumanji where they get sucked into the world of D&D. You thought it'd be like kind of like the original Jumanji where, like, that world sort of expands here, and it's kind of like that, but it's sort of by choice, not because the game demands it. But, like, I think both of our ideas would have been more exciting than this movie just because, you know, like Chris said, like, things would have actually happened.
That would have been cool. And also, I don't know, after watching this, I want to go back and, like, watch old sort of adventure fantasy films from the 80s and stuff. Like, I know, like,
Willow.
Eric Stoltz was in, like, Lionheart, where, like, I mean, that's not a fantasy or anything, but, like, it's during the Crusades, and it's about kids during the Crusades, and, like, you know, Matthew Broderick was in Lady Hawk and stuff. Like, there's a few out there that are actually pretty cool and, you know, worth your time and stuff. So, like, it's too bad that this didn't become modern kids get thrown back in time into sort of the medieval ages with, like, Merlin and stuff like that. Like, I could go for a good one of those these days.
Watch The Kid Who Would Be King, because no one else is, because that's that movie, basically. So, sort of, not really, but a little bit, with a lot more clapping and snapping. Austin, leave your thoughts about Mazes and Monsters before we Stanley ourselves into this movie.
I can't argue any of your points against the movie, because they're valid, and there are a lot of ways, I guess, this movie could have been better, but I still enjoyed it. I do recommend watching it. I would say definitely watch it before listening to this discussion, because I think you gotta go in blind. So, if you've made it this far, forget everything you've heard. Because I love not knowing what this movie turned out to be.
Because in a way, it is sort of exactly what you think it could be, and also, like, the exact opposite of what you think it could be. Like, it's this weird thing.
Yeah, and then another Dungeons & Dragons movie I would recommend is Shockma, which barely has any Dungeons & Dragons play in it.
We have a podcast on our network about Shockma, which I don't think was a very good movie. I think that's a terrible, terrible movie. Is that right, Chris?
It's got some really good monkey acting.
That's something.
Yeah, Shockma's amazing. It is a great film. But it's set up where they're all in this building to play Dungeons & Dragons, but they're quickly sidetracked because this angry baboon gets loose and starts trying to kill them all.
I just realized, Mike, that we have completed the Monkey Club set over the last two episodes. That we had Larson last week, and now we have Chris this week. So we have, got to catch them all. We have both Monkey Club co-hosts. But yeah, that's the OG Monkey Club podcast, Shockman on there, so go check that out.
You know, I think I'd like this movie more knowing it wasn't based on a true story and two books. Like, when I found that out, I think it kind of lost a little bit of its punch, because, like, watching it, I was like, oh, this is, like, kind of unique. You know, there's movies that are like, Psychosis movies and things like that that are out there and things, but, like, pairing it with Dungeons & Dragons thing, and that it's the new modern thing that everyone's sort of, like, parents are afraid of, it actually kind of paired pretty well to me, you know? Like, even though it's, like, a panic film and stuff, like, I guess I just thought, as a piece of fiction, I guess it works a lot better than knowing that it was, like, I'd actually kind of, you know, is based on something that sort of happened.
Its connection to the real story is so loose, though. Because it's just, the story is just this kid, and one of his hobbies was Dungeons & Dragons. And then this crazy detective who believes OJ is innocent made this connection and said it's because of Dungeons & Dragons. That's all there was this, like, panic. And I feel like the director was tasked with making a panic film, but kind of swayed it a different way, because by the end, like, those other kids are definitely fine. Like, I never felt like the game caused Tom Hanks's psychosis. Like, he was a mentally ill kid. So I felt like the movie at times was, like, trying to push it in a way like this was something dangerous, but, like, didn't really commit to it. And maybe that would have been better if it, like, fully committed to being, like, an insane panic film. I don't know. I'm trying to defend liking it, but I do get how it could be better. But yeah, I also liked that it didn't seem like it was blaming the game, and it was just about this kid with problems. So one more thing about the movie that I want to bring up is when they're at the Halloween party, somebody gives Tom Hanks a bottle of wine, and I'm pretty sure he said that it's from 1987. He's like, oh, 1987, great year for wine. But that's in the future. I could have misheard. I just wanted to see if you guys heard that.
No, let's just pretend that that is actually the case, because I like that better. Mike, any other thoughts about Mazes and Monsters? I think we covered it.
Yeah, we pretty much covered it. Like, I don't know if I'd call Hanks the lead even, per se, right? Like, because it kind of shifts to him. I don't know. It's okay. Nothing left to say about it.
Okay, so we have one more game to play here. Stan Lee yourself. So if you guys won a walk-on role into this TV movie, Mazes and Monsters, who would you be? What would you be playing? What character would you, like, what scene would you be in? Chris, if you won a walk-on role into Mazes and Monsters, where would you insert yourself into this movie?
I think I want to do, like, an irony kind of insertion. I feel like a lot of Stan Lee's cameos are kind of ironic. So I think I want to be, like, a jock guy who's like, D&D? That shit's for nerds. And, like, knocks a book out of Tom Hanks' hands or something.
I like that. I like that. Awesome. What about you? How would you put yourself into this movie?
I would either want to be just like some random person that Tom Hanks blesses on the streets of New York.
Please. Yes. That's all I want.
So maybe that, or I would love to be like one of the thugs, because I don't think I can play a thug, but I think it would be funny if I did. So yeah, I would like to be the thug sidekick who makes some wise cracks before his friend gets stabbed.
Yeah, definitely. Mike, what about you? Remembering, keeping in mind, you are a 40-year-old man.
I know, yes. Well, okay, so maybe I'm a professor that got invited to the Brigitte Bardot party, because I really want to go to this party. And in homage to Bosom Buddies, I'm going to dress in drag. So I'll walk by Hanks in drag and like be like, hey, man, welcome to the party, and just like keep on going.
I like that.
Yeah, that's a fun reference.
You know, where I'm going to put myself... on that roof, on that observation deck at the end, on the World Trade Center. And I'm going to be there with my family, and we're going to be taking pictures. And then all of a sudden, we realize that something else is going on this roof, and we cannot take our eyes off of Tom Hanks. Like, we are suddenly, like, within the world of the movie, transfixed on him, so... But yeah, that's how I would, you know, put myself in there. So we have an email address here on the show, hanks@cageclub.me. Let us know what you think of the show, of the episodes, of Mazes and Monsters. If you watch us on Amazon Prime, let us know what you thought of it. If there's something that we've missed that you want to hear us talk about. We also have a Patreon page. If you want to control what Mike and I watch, or just, you know, chip in a couple bucks, say thanks, say hi, patreon.com/cageclub. You can do that over there. So we have a very important question here. I think we're going to change it, Mike. We sort of talked a little bit about how we're going to change it for this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Does Tom Hanks act mirthful? Originally, we had this question, like, does he sort of, like, turn his head to the side and, like, gently, quietly chuckle to himself? But does he sort of resemble America's dad at any point in this movie? Is he the Tom Hanks that we love, basically, in this movie?
I don't think so. I think he's still kind of finding his place as an actor, and he's still experimenting, and he hasn't really found what he fits into best.
I feel like there's flashes of it at the beginning before we face off who the actual characters and the lead is in this movie. I feel like when he's in the car with his parents, or when he first sees the Mazes and Monsters sign, and he's like, no, I gotta like do class. I feel like he's a little bit Tom Hanks that I recognize there. That unfortunately does not last very long. You get flashes of it. He's a level 2 Hanks at this point. Needs to level up a bit more.
Yeah, and then the love montage where he and Kate are like falling for each other. They're smiling to each other. It was very sweet, and his smile is nice.
I do feel like there's glimpses of it there. It's just, you know, he has not, you know, leveled up enough. He's not level 9 Tom Hanks yet. He's still working his way up. So I'd say not yet, basically.
You know where it would have worked perfectly is walking around campus blessing people and giving away his possessions. Like, you totally would have had that air of mirthfulness to him as he's doing that. He'd have been in true form.
So the last thing that we have to do, the Tom Hanks Awards, whatever they're going to be, maybe the Golden Volleyballs, maybe the Golden Lassos from Toy Story, who knows what they'll be, but the best and the worst.
Real quick, Joey, I don't think this has come up yet, possibly, but does he have sex in this movie? Does his character? We could probably safely say that...
off screen, like his character has had sex, but...
Yeah, do we have a name for that yet? Can we derive a name from this film? Or are we going to still going with the train crash from Bosom Buddies when him and Sonny...
Does the train crash?
Well, maybe just touching, because when he breaks up with her, he's like, I can't touch you anymore.
Ooh, does he touch?
Oh, maybe he's got that Charlize Theron from Celebrity symptom where if you touch him, he just instantly orgasms.
Maybe,
him, so.
maybe.
So maybe that's his euphemism, is just like, oh, we touched the other night.
I like that, because, you know, Austin, like, I don't know if you've seen a lot of the Nick Cage movies. Have you seen The Boy in Blue?
Yeah.
We coined our term compromising from that because, you know, Cage compromised a woman by having sex with her. And so we're just like, oh, instead of, you know, just saying, you know, he had sex with a woman.
Yeah, and it was the 1800s. It was like 1890. So like,
yeah, he compromised in a lot of movies. So
I love that.
All right. So the best and the worst of Mazes and Monsters. I'm going to nominate this for worst film. I'm also going to nominate this not for worst role, but for most wasted performance. Because I feel like for someone who's trapped in the, you know, delusions of mania, there's so much more that they could have done here that they didn't. So I'm going to nominate that for that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other things here don't really apply. But is there anything else good or bad about this movie that you think that, you know, Mike or Chris or Austin, that we should nominate Mazes and Monsters for?
It's incredibly bad and the editing is gross, but like there's almost a part of me that thinks that this could only win worst movie, like because it's Tom Hanks. Because I've been on some pretty shit episodes of, not that the episodes were bad, some movies.
You have, yeah.
And if this was in Keanu's or Charlize's wheelhouse, like, it barely makes it past, like, the top 6 or 7 of the worst possible movies. So I think it's only there because it's Hanks's filmography is so prolific.
Yeah, like, that's something that, you know, we've said on the Cruise Club episodes, too, where, you know, these first 4 movies that he's in are not necessarily bad. They're just, knowing what's coming, they're like the worst that he's done. And so this is not the worst movie by a long stretch that I've ever seen. We talked about how like from like 93 to like 2000 or whatever, he like is in like 12 of the biggest movies of all time. And it's just like, oh, knowing what's coming, this is just sort of more disheartening or depressing or, you know, whatever by comparison.
Yeah, and in terms of bad movies that really push it too, you know, like this is No Endless Love, unfortunately, you know, Joey, like there's a movie that flies off the handles like right from the start and just keeps going and is just like terrific in that way.
Yeah, and this could have been that.
Yes, this, right, yeah, this had that potential.
Alas, it did not.
But I'm just saying, like, the only reason it's low on the list is because the lows are pretty high, surprisingly.
With that in mind, Mike, is there anything else that you want to nominate this movie for, or just the worst movie and most wasted performance?
What about that song? Does that get any props? Is there room for that song?
Remember the good times, please remember me. Whatever may happen, you'll know that I'll always be.
I mean, we could add best soundtrack / theme.
God knows we have enough categories and stuff, but if there was just some way we could work in that closing monologue or some kind of like best or worst voiceover or something.
Yeah, the problem with that is, and it's something that we sort of ran into with Charlize, like, it's worth remembering for sure, but it's not him. You know what I mean? Like, if it was him, like, if it was his friend who, like, had the break or whatever, for sure.
Okay, so does he have a best line? I wrote down, beware of the sacrilege. Is that worthy?
I'll make a note of that, beware of the sacrilege. Or, he says at one point, I think in his dream, or maybe to the mole man, I am Pardu and I am a holy man, so.
Like, that's pretty great. I kind of like that. If you see Hanks on the street and you don't walk up to him and say, I am Pardu, a holy man.
Yeah.
For shame on you, sir.
That's definitely something to take note of. But I think that's basically it. Like, I don't think there's anything, like, this movie is sort of, unfortunately, down the middle of the road in terms of a bad movie, like we're talking about, where it doesn't really warrant revisiting. Like, even, you know, Austin, I know that you enjoy this movie, but, like, of all the movies that are sort of, like, in this wheelhouse, I feel like there are better examples of, you know, sort of the good, bad, or the crazy, or the dangerous tales of youths doing things. Like, there's things here to scratch itches, but I feel like this is not the kind of movie that you're gonna revisit time and again, so I don't know.
Yeah, I guess not.
There's nothing wrong with liking it. I'm just saying, you know, it doesn't feel like the kind of movie that, like, you want to see over and over again, but maybe you do. I don't know.
No, it's true. There's nothing that would draw me to this again.
I think that ending really hooks you, though. You know what I'm saying? Like, even for me, I was like, did not think it was going to go in that direction. Like, it's a real Twilight Zone kind of ending, if you ask me. And that's good. I thought that was good.
Yeah, I just like the style of it.
It is better than any movie that has Dungeons and Dragons in its title. I will say that.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's fair. Very fair. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. Chris, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Now and Again, and also a little bit about how Now and Again is sort of shifting a little bit, changing a little bit for 2019.
Yeah, so Now and Again is a podcast where Nico Vasillo, who is on a million other shows on the Cage Club Network, and myself are working our way through the Now That's What I Call Music compilation collection. We are currently somewhere around 2006 and volume 22, but we do a lot of side jaunts just to talk about pop music in general, current music. We did a best of recently, and for April, on the very first episode of the show, we joked about a hypothetical podcast where we cover 1 minute of Carly Rae Jepsen's Emotion every episode, and it just kind of became this running joke, and we're not exactly going to do that, but we are going to take about 4 months and cover only Carly Rae Jepsen songs individually. So if any of that appeals to you, which I'm not sure why it would, come check us out at Now and Again. We have some fun over there on that show.
Well, did you hear the big news today as we're recording, you know, last week as you're listening to this? There's apparently the new trailer for the new season of Queer Eye is out, and there's a new Carly Rae Jepsen song teased in the trailer. So, you know, she is in the news as we're recording this.
Aw, shit. That is something to get excited about. There's got to be new music soonish.
And also, why don't you tell our listeners about Cinema Stories, your quirky, delightful movie reviews on YouTube?
Yeah, search my name is the easiest way to find it. So there's 100 episodes now. The longest one is probably 4 minutes. They're really short. I do them on Instagram first, and they're cut up into 15-second increments, and they're just jokes and thoughts and dumb shit about movies that I watch, and mostly like obscure genre movies, because those are the kind of movies I like best. And then Wolf Southern is my name on Letterboxd or Instagram, so it's just as one word, wolf like the animal and southern with no U.
We'll link to that on the cageclub.me page for the show, so if you want to check out either Cinema Stories or his Twitter, you know, you can go from there. But yeah, so thank you both for joining us for this weirdo little sort of, you know, side note, footnote in the career of Tom Hanks. But again, important in that it is his first starring role, quote-unquote starring role, so thank you both for being here. Now, before we close up shop today, Mike, next week on Cruise Club, you know, we alternate Hanks and Cruise, next week we have Risky Business. So I know you've seen Risky Business. I have never seen Risky Business. Here's what I know about it. I know that he gets in his underwear and slides down the hall to some song. Based on our conversation with Larson last week on Losing It, I know that he's trying to seduce an older woman. Here's my guess for what Risky Business is about.
Real quick, I was just going to ask if Austin and Chris had seen Risky Business too.
I have seen Risky Business.
I also know about I at least know what song it is. I only know the underwear scene, and I know literally nothing about Risky Business.
It's definitely a movie that was different than I expected.
Okay. If you want to workshop ideas with me here, Chris, you can. Feel free to jump in. So I think that Tom Cruise is a high schooler. I think that his parents go out of town for the weekend, and he, you know, has a crush on an older woman. Maybe it's an older high school girl. Maybe it's a college girl. Maybe it's a neighborhood girl, whatever. And he wants to impress her, so he throws a party, and things get out of hand. And in the end, he wins her over by being, you know, not his wild party-going self, but just by being, you know, the virtue of being, you know, a good, nice, normal kid. That's my guess. And, you know, the sliding down the hallway in his underwear scene is him sort of prepping for the party. Like, that's his, like, getting psyched up while he's getting the house ready. That's where that, I think, fits in. That's my guess. I don't know. We'll find out next week. But, Chris, do you have any sort of thoughts, any other ideas to add in there? Do you think that's, you know, as good a guess as any?
So I had no idea that it was about him trying to seduce an older woman. If you, like, gun to my head, asked me what Risky Business was about, what I've always thought this movie was about, and I have no idea, I've never seen it. I don't know why I think this is what the movie's about. I think he's a college kid who is house-sitting, and it's like Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo. Like, he uses that opportunity to just have sex with people, to be like a male escort. I don't know why I think that is, but I don't know if that's right at all. I have no clue, but in my head, that's what the movie is.
Well, in both of our things, empty house, sex with women, we're going to find out next week on Cruise Club. So yeah, alternating tom-toms, last week Losing It, next week Risky Business. Right here we've got Mazes and Monsters. Seemingly has nothing to do with either of those movies, but come back in a week for Risky Business on Cruise Club, and come back in 2 weeks for Family Ties, 3 episodes of Family Ties here on Hanks for the Memories. But for all things Tom Hanks and Hanks for the Memories, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, hanks@cageclub.me. Go to patreon.com/cageclub to, you know, chip in a couple bucks. Choose what Mike and I watch if you want to do that sort of thing. Come back in a week, like I said, for Risky Business on Cruise Club on a different podcast feed. And then in 2 weeks for Family Ties. 3 episodes, early Family Ties, right here on Hanks of the Memories. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Austin Wolf Southern and Chris Podcast, and we'll see you in a week or two, depending on which tom-tom you want to listen to, right here on Hanks for the Memories.
Whatever may happen, where the road may bend, always remember we are our special friends.
I am Pardieu. I am a holy man.
I'm the King of France.
Your Majesty.